You're listening to The Fifth Estate from the Wheeler Center. In this week's episode, we hear from two historians, Geoffrey Blainey and Claire Wright, who talk about the process and practice of writing Australian history. Here's our host, Sally Warhaft.
It is such a great thrill tonight to have our two guests with us. Geoffrey Blainey, Professor Geoffrey Blainey, is the author of almost 40 books, and I brought with me what I could carry in one bag between these two, what they've written. Geoffrey's got a few years yet on you, Claire, but your books are not light. I brought a sort of a cross between what I could carry and my favourites, Geoffrey. So they include The Tyranny of Distance, Triumph of the Nomads, Black Kettle and Full Moon, Daily Life in a Vanished Australia, The Tyranny of Distance, The Rise of Broken Hill, The Peaks of Lyell, Short History of the 20th Century, A Land Half Won, A History of Victoria, A Game of Our Own, Minds in the Spinifex about Mount Isa, Histories of Alcoa, of Dunlop, of the National Bank of Australasia, and his latest book, Before I Forget, which is a memoir of the first 40 or so years of Geoffrey's life. Geoffrey has been translated and read all across the globe. He's formerly a professor at Melbourne University, formerly a professor of Australian Studies at Harvard University, former chairman of the Australia Council, the National Council for the Centenary of Federation, the Australia-China Council, and a national living treasure. Please welcome Geoffrey Blainey. And Associate Professor and Principal Research Fellow Claire Wright, a historian at La Trobe University, the author of the award-winning books The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, You Daughters of Freedom, and Beyond the Ladies' Lounge. And Forgotten Rebels is currently being developed into a 10-episode TV series. She's a celebrated radio and television broadcaster, including Utopia Girls on the ABC, and a podcaster. And her latest podcast series is Archive Fever. Claire, I should also just mention, is a director on the Wheeler Centre board. Please welcome Claire Wright. And some of these books will be for sale from Hill of Content, thank you, after the event. So we're here to talk about history, Australian history. And I wanted to start, I was on an aeroplane last week flying to Canberra, reading your memoir, Geoff, and there was an announcement by the flight attendant that interrupted my reading, to say that there was a guest on board the plane who was celebrating her 100th birthday. Her name was Mrs. Bollard. And everybody, there was a pause, a beautiful pause, and then a very moving round of applause. And it got me thinking about various things, about time mainly, of course, and the idea that almost every human being can acknowledge what an innings, a century is. But also then I went back to your book and I realised you're 90 next year.
Am I?
Yes, apparently. Pretty consistent. And that, you know, your first book was written in a fountain pen.
That's right.
So tell us, to begin, about your sense of time and particularly the idea of, say, 100 years and how, as an historian, you think about that.
Thanks very much for the generous introduction. I've got a strong sense of time, not as strong as it should be, and when people started to talk about Aboriginal history and the enormous length of time, it took me, I think, some years to fit that into my calendar into my time frame. But I think the passing of time, even though we're all victims of it, is one of the magical and mysterious things of life. And it's wonderful to talk to people who talk about events when long before you were born, and to see the way they saw them and the sense of presence that they had. So that you may not agree, Claire, but I don't think you can be a historian without a sense of time.
Is it a particular sense, do you think, Claire? How do you think of it?
Well, in a personal sense, just riffing on what you're saying now, turning 90 next year, and Mrs. McGillicuddy turning 100.
Mrs. Bollard.
Apologies, Mrs. Bollard. I just turned 50 this year, and I had a very strong sense. I didn't think that it was going to mean very much. I didn't think of it, in terms of the ageing process or women's invisibility or a lot of things that people consider is going to be an anxiety for women as they get older. What I had a really strong sense of was the hourglass tipping over, and that if, the sands had been running one way for the past, say, 30 years of a working life, that they had tipped and there were 30 more years, touch wood, to come. And what do you want to make of those? I think when you're younger, you're just, you're just striding ahead and you're striving and you might be ambitious and you might have a desire to change things, change narratives, leave the world a better place than you found it. But without any sort of end sense, there's no end of time in a way. And so, for me, it wasn't about mortality. It was just about, well, hang on, there's probably a limited period left. And if I just, want to boil it down to numbers, I got 36 more books to write to catch up to Bugalugs over here. So, it's kind of sobering in that sense. That's in a personal reflection. But I agree, to be an historian, you do need to have a sense of time. And for me, I often extend my perspective on time forward rather than backwards. Obviously, we deal with the past in terms of the nuts and bolts of what we do. But when I interview people in the chair, I remember interviewing Julia Gillard a couple of years ago, and I said to her, how would you like historians to remember you in 100 years' time? So I think about that a lot. What will the historians be writing? I like to say to politicians, be careful what you say in Parliament, because there's this thing called Hansard. And in 100 years' time, historians will hold you to account in exactly the way that I held the protagonists who were debating the Franchise Act in 1902 to account, just merely by, in a sense, restating their words. You don't even have to analyse it. You can give them enough rope. So it's often by casting forward that I get a sense of what it means to act in the moment and what that might mean in a larger global and intellectual sense.
Well, I might give you both a little go at that and ask, Geoffrey, how do you think historians might look back on this period of Australian moments in 100 years?
What would Australians think in 100 years' time of what, the last 25 years in Australia?
Well, no, in 100 years from now, how do you think historians might look back at 2019, 2020, at this period in our history?
I would suspect that historians looking back 100 years to our day will strongly disapprove of some of the things that we think are wonderful and marvel that we didn't make changes that they saw as an essential part of our history. It's very difficult to predict, isn't it?
Please tell us more about what those things might be.
Well, one of the important things, they will know more about climate change than we can possibly know, won't they? They will know more about what education should be like. I think at the moment they probably will say that there's some kind of a crisis in education in Australia, with our standards falling behind so many countries we compare ourselves with, and there's nothing we can do about it. And I think that will probably interest them, because I was in the tram the other day, and yesterday, and four Aborigines jumped in wearing jacket like Claire's, and the jacket said, "Education changes lives." They were from the Cathy Freeman Foundation, and I thought about that. Some generations, education does change lives. Other generations, education doesn't seem to be so effective.
Why do you think?
Well, I think some generations expect too much of education, especially of schools. After all, the influence is on a kid today compared to when I was 10, a manifold, a profound, the influence of their peer group is much larger, isn't it? The influence of churches or rationalists or like institutions is much less. The new forms of media are influencing them in ways that are unimaginable. When young, I had a crystal set. So that I think it's much more difficult now to shape children's lives than it was in a simpler era. And maybe we're expecting too much of schools, because the other influences are often far more powerful than the schools. Mm. And I don't think that was so in 1900.
Mm. Claire?
Can I take issue with a simpler era? Because I don't jerry with that concept. I think what being an historian shows you, and your books are, document this, to a great degree, Geoffrey, is that every era is complex in its own way, and that it is that a good historian, and I think you're a great historian, puts yourself in the minds of the people who were there at the time. It gives you a sense of being there. And if you truly are there, you realise how complex it is. Maybe kids, they didn't have social media or TikToks to practice at home, they maybe it didn't have so much information coming to their heads or cyberbullying, but they had mothers who died in childbirth. And they had their families split up after a father died in a mining accident, for example. And so, there were all sorts of levels of precarity in kids' lives then that I don't think that they have to deal with or experience now. So I don't think any era is simple. I think we can, that is a nostalgia for the past, that actually it's the role of the historian to dispel.
Yes, I take your point. I think I think nonetheless that lives of children in 1850 in Australia were probably subject to fewer influences, and especially influences of which their parents had no knowledge than children of today. I take your point that mortality was like an umbrella over your whole life, wasn't it? And the number of women who had 10 children and they'd all survive would be tiny, wouldn't it? And the husband was usually dead by the age of 50. I mean, that's why we could introduce the old age pensions so easily, because there's hardly anybody eligible.
It might be why marriages were more successful more often too, but just a thought. Claire, I didn't give you the opportunity to answer the question about the 100 years and how historians might look at today.
One of the things that I love about being an historian and doing history is that it makes me an optimist in all sorts of regards, because I think that we often, there's that aphorism about we fail to learn, if we don't understand our past, we fail to learn from its lessons, and history repeats itself, and those tend to be kind of negative conceptions of history. But history makes me an optimist, because I think we can see how quickly it's possible for things to change. I think that within, the women who were advocating for the vote and winning those historic rights in Australia at the turn of the century, and then going on to advocate for the very age pensions that Geoff is talking about, and making Australia the first country in the world that did have the age pension, those women would just, their heads would have exploded to imagine that we would have a female prime minister within three, four generations. It was beyond their conception. And so I find it really exciting, because I think it's really difficult to project forward and see how much is going to change and how quickly. But I'm also excited because history is written by historians, and historians are human beings who ask questions. And I don't know what questions those historians in the future are going to ask. So, you know, Geoffrey and I could write about the very same landscape of the Eureka Stockade, Ballarat in 1854, using almost identical primary sources, and come up with a very different reading of what happened in that year, who it happened to and who was making things happen, because we asked different questions of the archive, questions that it wouldn't have occurred to Geoffrey in the 1960s when you wrote The Rush That Never Ended, occurred to me, 40 years later, because I was raised in a different social, cultural and political context. So I asked, where are the women in this story? Where am I? Am I there? Is it possible that there might have been, that I might have been there? And then you go back and you ask the archive that question, and then you come up with different answers. So I don't know what the historians in 100 years' time will be asking, what questions they'll be asking of the documents that we have today that will tell the story of today. Because I don't know what forces are going to shape them. That, to me, is a really exciting prospect.
Mm. There was a very interesting article last week in The Australian by Professor Greg
from Wollongong.
Yes, that's right, from Wollongong University.
Greg Malouche.
Malouche, thank you very much. And Greg is a judge on the Australian Prime Minister's Literary Awards in the history and non-fiction categories, and I should disclaimer here that so am I. And he wrote a terrific piece, a really interesting article on his take on the kind of books that have been coming across our judging table for the past 3 years and patterns that he'd observed. And he says that historians have become much more specialised in recent years, and they claim a patch of territory and stick with it and sort of farm it until it's exhausted. And that this is a really big change in writing Australian history, that it's very rare now to find a more sweeping history that perhaps covers all of Australia, or the kinds of things, of course, that you've written a lot of. I wondered what you think of that impression, and how else the discipline of history has changed. Geoffrey, you go first, Geoff. Yeah.
I think Greg is right that history is becoming more professional, and people are taking smaller territories, just as in medicine. They're more specialised than the GP has to refer people constantly to the specialist. That seems to be one of the facets of modern life. It makes it very difficult to teach a subject, though, doesn't it, when even the teachers haven't put together all the fragments that make together the whole. So I think it's much harder to teach history at a higher level than it was when I first went to the university in 1948. And that's a great pity. After all, history is useful thoughts to offer, useful statements of probability, useful warnings, and they should be given. But it's very hard to give a useful warning if you spend all your life in one small piece of territory and don't keep up to date with what's happening in other areas. So that I think he's right, but I don't know what the answer is.
I mean, it means also, as he pointed out, that getting something like a Manning Clark, six volume history of Australia probably would never be able to happen today. Claire?
Well, I think he's right, but I also think he's wrong. I think he's right to make that observation, but I think that he's incorrect in assuming that is to the detriment of history writing and to reading audiences. Because I think that one of the things those big sweeping histories are premised on is an overarching narrative. And the problem with trying to write a history like that today is that it inevitably has all sorts of gaps and ellipses that do not square with a modern sensibility that requires a certain accountability to a variety of stakeholders and interest groups, and that tells it might be a more narrow cast story in some ways, but in other ways those histories often actually take in a much wider range of perspectives than have ever been covered in those wide sweeping tomes. You know, if you look at Manning Clark, you know, yes, great sweep of history, but a very narrow group of people who is actually ultimately writing about. And so I think what a lot of revisionist history has done, I think there's two reasons why we're seeing this move to more micro kind of histories in that sense. One, there's a revision of those texts. It's a recognition that women, Indigenous people, migrants, non-English people from non-English speaking backgrounds, they were not accounted for in the history of Australia. And so it's a version of a history of Australia that tends to be dominated by the historians that were writing those histories at the time. The other reason is that we have far more postgraduate students coming out of universities who are attempting to publish their PhDs, and PhDs do tend to be more narrow focused and more specialist knowledge. I don't think this is a bad thing, because I think we're seeing, this is weird that this is the one that came into my head, but I read a book a couple of years ago now that was written by a guy, Raiden Dunbar, and it was about VD in the Anzac forces. Now, on the one level, you could say, well, you know, that's a really specialised area of history, and what does that have to contribute to our great national story? On the other hand, you say, well, that research that he has done is an extraordinarily important corrective to a whole set of mythologies that have been disseminated in those more sweeping nationalist, and they can often be then read as quite jingoistic, versions of Australian nationhood and national identity. And so, you know, that's one example, but there are many, many more.
I'm surprised you've given that one too, it's a military history. And well, because you're, you know, I often hear you guiding people away from, you know, that's not the only history to tell in Australia. There's so much military history.
There is so much military history. We have gone through a period over the last 20 years of the militarisation of Australian history. There is absolutely no doubt about that, both in the proliferation of publishing around military history and also the importance that military stories have taken in our understanding of who Australians are and what it means to be an Australian and Australian achievement. And Australians' contribution to world history. And that has been, you know, there's been a very deliberate and well-funded move towards that. And unfortunately, there's a lot of drawbacks to that, and one of them is that the militarisation of history also tends towards the masculinisation of history. I suppose why I plucked that example out is that it's a very different version of masculinity. That particular strand of research, which can be seen as being very specialised, and you know, Greg Malouche might put it in his too narrow basket, but actually, like all good histories, it leads to more questions. It is subversive in some kind of way, because it doesn't sandbag a version of ourselves. It points to cracks in the version of ourselves. And those cracks are where the light of more questions and therefore more history writing gets in.
Mm. I think I agree with parts of what you say, of course, but your comment on Manning Clark is perhaps not quite fair, because he began his series in the early 1960s when knowledge of prehistory was tiny, when people, as you say, were much less interested in the social history, which is vital for women and their lives. But Manning did write an overriding history, an overriding narrative, and for all his faults, it's better that we as readers have an overriding narrative or various overriding narratives of the history of our country than no overriding narrative. We can't expect the students or the teachers themselves, can we, to supply an overriding narrative unless they're professional historians who, with all our weaknesses, are trying to do it.
I think you need both.
Yes, you do.
As a reader, I certainly need both. I wonder what you think is missing in this era of high specialisation. Geoffrey, what do you think is missing in history at the moment that you would either like to do yourself or have somebody else do for you?
Well, historians are covering a far wider range of subjects than they did when I was young. There's no doubt about it. So that the sum total of knowledge that's available is enormous. Mm-hmm. Compared to the late 1940s when I first studied, but at the same time, it's very difficult to turn the confetti into a piece of paper again. And students or politicians or teachers, they need an overriding narrative or alternative overriding narratives so that they can see the world as a whole. I mean, one of the present difficulties, I think, is that people either study the European history of Australia since 1788, or they study, relatively few of them, the Aboriginal history and Torres Strait Islander history before 1788. I think you need really to be in both territories if you're going to teach. You may not be a specialist, but to be in both territories, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, neither of you do really teach, and I'm wondering if that's become a sort of prerequisite for getting writing done, of being able to write books for large audiences. I mean, I'm sure you'd both be marvellous teachers. Is it a decision that you sort of made because you wanted to write, Claire?
It's a decision that I made because I didn't want to teach. Which is, I mean, I do teach. I teach postgraduate students and honours students. I supervise. But unfortunately, the way things have gone in the tertiary sector, if you teach, it is very difficult to research and write because you not only teach, you administrate. And there are so few teachers now. When I started at La Trobe in 2004, there were 22 full-time staff in the history department. Mm. And now there are 9. And the numbers of students haven't decreased. And so that just means the load on those teachers is enormous. And yes, I do want to write, and like all of us want to write. That doesn't make, I'm not unique in that. All historians want to write. Actually, more what they want to do is they want to research. I mean, that's what we get into it for in the first place. We just bloody love being in libraries and archives and researching. And that's the thrill of it. And then the challenge of it is to write up that research. And for me, the challenge of it, and I've very much been guided by Geoffrey's writing in this, the challenge of it has been to write for broad audiences, so that you're not speaking to the academy most of the time, which is unfortunately where a lot of history writing and academic writing in general goes. And if I had a criticism of those more narrow cast books, it's that the audiences that they're written for are often also very narrow. And I don't think that it has to be that way. I think that what we need in the university is people to teach other historians how to unlearn what they learnt as academics in order to write more accessibly. And so for me, doing public speaking and doing radio and doing television has been beneficial, I think, to my writing, because you develop more of a toolbox for communication and therefore can get the real, you know, the guts, the good stuff out of that research, and people can connect with those stories. And no, I don't think that if you earn a salary as a full-time lecturer in a university, you have the time or the brain space to be able to do those things.
This is I agree with your general point, but as for teaching, we're teaching tonight.
Yeah.
Learning, but we're teaching. I'm giving 4 speeches this week on different subjects to very different audiences. If a university invited me and I were free, I would go, but there's an enormous thirst for knowledge.
Mm.
May I understand this was booked out, is that right, soon after you?
Very soon after it was put up, yeah.
Well, that's a good point. I spoke to 150 people in Shepparton last night and about Your Daughters of Freedom, and because I was invited and because I agree with you, there is a great thirst for knowledge. Mm. People want to hear the stories and they want to hear you talk about it. And then I think the other important point that you've raised is about teaching in high schools, about school history as well. And you've talked about, you know, that in terms of history education. I think that that's vital, and it's one of the reasons that there is a young adult version of The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, and there will be one for Your Daughters of Freedom as well, because it actually gives history teachers and who often aren't trained specialists, they're humanities teachers usually, the resources to be able to teach more of the story through a wider range of perspectives to their students to help their students engage. And that's what teachers are really crying out for, is teaching resources.
I want to go back, I think, to a point you made much earlier about life, you believing that life is more complicated now for young people and you not so much. I'm with Geoffrey on this one. I think life has always been complicated for people, for human beings. But I think what technology has done and globalisation has done. And one of the things that just got me back thinking about it is about the classroom and how people learn. Geoffrey, when you were a boy, I think about 10, when the war broke out, 9 or 10, is that right, if I got my arithmetic?
I was 9.
Nine. Mm. At that time, you write in your memoir that you never, or after the war, you weren't taught about that war.
No.
It was never taught. You were taught about wars in the century before.
Mm.
And younger people today are taught at a much more rapid, I think, things, you know, they're learning about the issues of the day much more rapidly than at the pace things were done when you were at school. And I wonder how that changes the way people learn and think, particularly about history, when there's less history because you're just trying to keep up with what's coming in so rapidly from every direction all the time.
Well, when the war broke out in 1939, we'd moved from Leongatha in South Gippsland to Geelong, and I had by 1940 a newspaper around, and I especially remember the Saturday night when I had to go with my pushbike to the Geelong railway station, to the guards van, and pick up the last editions of the Sporting Globe and the Melbourne Herald that just arrived. And I'd take my bike along the streets of West Geelong and the people would be waiting at the gate to grab the newspaper. The newspaper was much more important then than radio for the news. And they'd often be quite agitated, and they would take the paper and run inside without even tipping me. So I've got a vivid memory of it. But I learned a bit by reading the headlines myself, and I had a section of the backyard that my father didn't use, and I made little trenches there. I assumed that this was like the First World War and they were fighting in trenches, and I dug little zigzag trenches and put little sticks over them and so forth. But I was never taught anything about the war in all the years, wartime years, I was at school. On the other hand, maybe there was much more concentration on the past than on the immediate. I mean, the present generation of children are absorbed in the immediate, aren't they? They've got their little sets and they read them in the trams and the trains, and they learn a lot of everyday news, don't they? I mean, the reason why so many children are marching across Flinders Street and say, well, it's because they've read the day's news and somebody else has told them. That would be inconceivable. Of course, we're also suffering from wartime censorship. You know, a lot of the war news is bad and it's not distributed. It's the essence of an important war is you don't tell the news.
Yeah.
You have to censor it. It's all important for morale, right or wrong.
Mm. You're now part of history.
What?
You are. You're living history. I mean, you are. You are one of the only Australians I can think of where terms have been coined that are part of. They're not just phrases. They're deep ways that we understand or think about our country. The tyranny of distance, the black armband view of history. These are two that are. Absolutely, you know, any adult Australian will have heard, and many young people, younger, that what these terms mean. That is to become part of history to be able to do that. How do you think about that, doing that, coming up with those phrases and the way that they're used?
Well, I didn't know at the time I first used them that they would be important, and there may be something that Claire writes next year, which he thinks, oh, I finished today's work, thank God. But in 4 years' time, people will say, where did that phrase come from? I mean, you don't determine whether a phrase will take on, do you?
No,
but hashtag career goals.
When it does, yeah, I'm sure yours is already brewing, and we just haven't recognised it yet. But particularly, let's take the black armband phrase, because that was one that, as you have always pointed out, was in a speech that you gave, there was barely any notice of it, and it wasn't until it was used by the Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, that it took off. How do you reflect on that now? Was it ever used in ways, or ever, that really frustrated you or saddened you?
Well, I think when the phrase black armband became popular, people hadn't read the original article. Why should they? And they didn't know what it meant. A lot of the people thought it was an attack on Aborigines, whereas the article in many ways is a strong defence of Aborigines in the history. But people only have a sip of the news, don't they? And so they don't know what else is in the news or what else is in the phrase, like black armband or tyranny of distance. So misunderstanding is inevitable for a while, and one of the things that enables a phrase to carry more than perhaps it deserves to carry is it's got triple meanings or double meanings. A phrase that's not completely clear is more likely to carry but to be used by a variety of people than a phrase which is crystal clear and therefore narrow.
But did it can I ask a question? Did it concern you when it was interpreted in that way that you might not have meant? Because it had a very destructive effect, and you know, in some ways was one of the fuses that lit the history wars and the culture wars that we're still fighting, despite the fact that Scott Morrison wants to pretend that we're not. So, I mean, did you try to distance yourself from it or to clarify what you meant so that you wouldn't be taken out of context?
I think you've asked a similar question in a different way, really, in a way. I mean, go ahead.
It's a lot of things you write are misunderstood to some degree, especially if they're written in a book, because you can have more qualifications in a book, can't you? Can say, on the other hand, and you can give some attention to a minority view, even if you don't support it yourself. Whereas the news, especially the modern news, comes in very short clippings, and so the chances of misunderstanding are much higher. I think when I was young, I was very disappointed when I was misunderstood. I didn't realise that to be misunderstood is the way of the world. And that's why we have debate. It's debate that brings out. Democracy is government by debate, and the virtue of democracy is all kinds of arguments which were misunderstood are discussed in a way that eventually people say, well, I can see that that point is important, even if I disagree with the other. So to me, debate is all important, and misunderstanding is part of the pathway towards debate in a mass democracy such as we have. I'm a Democrat, by the way.
So it doesn't bother you. It wasn't something that, you know, you'd put it out there, and how people use it, it's out of your hands.
It is out of your hands, although, as Claire would say, you can intervene and you can try to take it out of the hands of the public or whoever it is misinterpreting it. You can do that, but there's a limit to how much you can do that. I mean, I've been in a lot of controversies. You can't run too many at the one time.
It's interesting because nowadays they call it, you know, in Twitter, I think, you know, the pile on. When somebody does or says something, or somebody thinks something's been said or done, and everyone piles on, and it's just all a lot more rapid. What took 3 years, I suppose, now happens instantly. The winner of the History Prize for the Prime Minister's Prize this year, which is a marvellous book, The Bible in Australia by Meredith Lake, and there wasn't much of it. There wasn't a lot, but there was some reaction.
Are you one of the judges?
Yes, I am. Maybe. I am. About, you know, oh, this must have been the Prime Minister who, you know, overran the judge's decisions because, you know, he's religious and this book has the word Bible in it, and all these assumptions, and people just jump on. They jump on, and then you suddenly start realising, has any one person here actually read the book? And in a similar way that I've, you know, how many people, was it a speech or an article, the original black armband?
It was made in a speech in honour of Sir John Latham, who was the former Chief Justice at Sydney University. They had an annual lecture in honour of Sir John Latham. And speeches that often you put on the speech, to writing the speech to the very end, but it must have been in my head. And you write the speech, and by writing it, it becomes somehow more than jelly. So it was a Sydney occasion. Not many people were there.
Mm. Yeah. You left Melbourne University because you say you wanted to be able to say whatever you wanted.
Yes.
And that's a very sad thing to read, a statement like that you wouldn't have felt you could be the historian you are in an academic setting.
But it was the right decision. We've only got one life, and I'd had a good period as a teacher at various universities. I enjoyed teaching very much, and but there was a fair bit of opposition to the views. I wasn't speaking about current affairs, but my view of history wasn't the view of the majority of people on the staff, and that's all right. I thought, well, I can live in a more congenial climate. So I read for the newspapers, and that became my school, my lecture class. I lectured in ships. I mean, that's been one of the great experiences of my life, lecturing in ships and meeting so many people who will tell you privately and anonymously what's happening in their occupation or what did. So that, you know, I'm glad I left university because I entered a new life. And you don't have many chances in one life to move into another.
Mm.
So I'm not sad that I've gone.
Claire, do you feel the constraints of an academy that sometimes from the outside can look like it thinks as a pack?
Now, you know, there's a lot of discussion about academic freedom now, and my university is going through a lot of soul searching about how to define what it is appropriate to say and how you say it and what freedoms are going to be allowed but I've never felt the constraint. The only time I felt the constraint was when I was at the university that had the institutional pile on Jeffrey. at the University of Melbourne, where I felt that there was much more of a concern about protecting the brand of the institution, and therefore there was. It wasn't that anybody told you that you what to say or that you couldn't say anything. There was just a kind of a sense of a cultural impediment to saying anything at all, really. a feeling that, you know, doing what is now called public engagement, you know, it's had academic citizenship. There's been lots of different terms for it, public outreach, things that have come quite naturally to me. At the time at Melbourne Uni, that was just sort of, that I was there, that was just kind of seen as showing off, really, and that it wasn't quite cricket to stand outside the rest of your colleagues, and that you had to be very careful that you weren't in any way going to tarnish the brand. And it's why I went to La Trobe, which is a university that has a strong heritage of public intellectuals. As you well know, you've worked with many of them, Robert Mann and Judy Brett and Dennis Altman and Marilyn Lake and Inga Clendinning. And I don't think that's an accident that so many of those have come out of La Trobe. It is a university that right from the beginning had much more of a kind of value system that wasn't about elitism and status, that was about having open education, access to education by a diverse number of groups in society. And therefore, I think its academics have also had more license to speak more freely about a whole range of topics. So I haven't felt this personally. I felt nothing but encouragement. But it is a big issue in the universities generally about what an academic can say and a university and their university will still support them as part of academic freedom of speech.
I feel like these debates in Australia are especially bitter. But, you know, I haven't been everywhere, so I don't know if that's true. Do you have a sense of that?
I don't think they are. I think that campus life on American colleges is much more difficult to negotiate. I think that there's a lot more sensitivity, particularly in identity or politics, and that people are that academics feel much more constrained in those environments than we do. I think that we you know, apart from the extreme lack of funding, we have it pretty good as academics. I think that we have to be much more concerned about things like the university's closing down their chairs of Australian literature and reducing faculties from 22 to 8 than we have about actually who can say what. I actually think that that's a bit of a smokescreen for what's going on a much more structural level, which is undermining the ability of academics to work creatively and without levels of, you know, insane stress because of how badly resourced Australian universities are.
Can I add to Claire's point? There's a man I know who's been both an English and an Australian academic. He comes out to see the start of the cricket season here every year. He stays only for a week or two and then goes back to England, very well informed. We had a cup of coffee last week and he told me about Cambridge. And he said, the funny thing about Cambridge is, he said, the historians, the savagery with which they attack each other. He said people in other departments are astonished. Mm. Mm. He said the engineers are especially astonished because they tend to build rather than destroy. I think history lends itself to disputes because history really is important. So many of the interesting issues, the issues that we're debating or we have debated in the last 25 years, they do, Claire, don't they? Have a history component, whether we should become a republic, whether the Aborigines should be specified in the Constitution, whether climate change is man-made or part of a cycle. All those have a historical component, and since they're questions which will determine whether some people will have power and some won't, they're questions which determine whether what you believe in will succeed or not. Naturally, historians are central to that debate. And you tell me an issue in the last 25 years in Australia that stirs people but does not have a history component.
And that's why we have history wars and not engineering wars or anthropology wars or...
Medical wars, can you imagine?
Or planning wars.
Planning wars. You know, I mean, it is... It's really true. There's always an historical component because it so does speak to who we are now and because history is so often used in the service of who we are now. To my mind, it's no accident that John Howard poured an enormous amount of money into Anzac remembrance and into the militarisation of history and into the idea that Australia's the nation was born at Gallipoli, and you can see this through the funding streams. I mean, he wasn't the only one to do it. There had already been the Australia Remembers campaign of the anniversary of the Second World War. Keating was involved in, but it really hit a high point then. And the idea that the true Anzac spirit, the true Australian spirit, lay in the sacrifice and the fighting for our freedom that happened in the First World War. And he used that as a basis to send Australia into two wars, the Iraq War and Afghanistan. And there, you can use history as a way of bolstering current policy and current directions that you want the nation to take, in a way that I don't think has that same kind of resonance with other fields of discourse. It's one of the reasons that I love Billy Griffith's book that's out at the moment, Deep Time Dreaming. You mentioned earlier, Geoffrey, that the idea of that Australia has this deep time, 60,000 years of history, is kind of anathema to where you started your career. But one of the reasons that that's such an important book is because it is melding the way that we understand history with other disciplines like archaeology and anthropology, and it shows that all of these people, these practitioners from these disciplines, have been telling the story of us, and it's one version of the story of us, and we can completely break that apart with the use of science and with the use of things like carbon dating. And this is why this is such a rich, fertile field at the moment, and so exciting that we have this kind of rewriting of Australia's past, not just from the point of view of an historian, but from archaeology and from science and from, Bruce Pascoe with Indigenous knowledges and looking at agriculture and agricultural techniques. And this gives us so much more to be able to deal with what sort of country we want to be in the future, what sort of nation we want to build for ourselves.
Geoffrey, you've been a great reviser of your work. You continually write about going back and rethinking, looking back at your own work to test what you've learned since and so on. What have you changed your mind about over time that's really surprised you or moved you?
What things over time, in my lifetime?
Or in the time that you've been revising your own work.
Well, I'm surprised that I've become so interested in ancient history and prehistory, in the early history of mankind. I had no interest at all in it. In fact, I went on the first big archaeological expedition in Australia where John Mulvaney dug in a cave at Manum overlooking the Murray in South Australia. I wasn't really interested in what he was doing because I couldn't see how relevant. There was no radiocarbon dating then. And suddenly when he pushed back the known history of Aboriginal occupation of Australia from, 2,000 or 3,000 years, in one go back to 6,000 years, and then back it went. I had no idea that that was significant. Soon I did, but at the time I had no idea, which is a sign of how little we're interested in Aboriginal history and how little knowledge we have. Of course, it's hard to be interested in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island history if you've got no chronology. You really have to have chronology, don't you? Mm. Otherwise, there's too much unknown. So, and I'm astonished. I wouldn't have thought so when I was aged 20, but I think the great changer of the world and the great changer of Australia in the last 100 years is technology. Technology and science, but I think technology is more important. Our way of life has changed far more by technology, whether for women or for men or for children, than by any other factor. I wouldn't have dreamed when I first went to university and listened to lectures, very good lectures, that thing which was completely missing then would come to my mind to be so important. And we really got a good education. You can only judge it by the standards of the time. I'm so grateful to the people who taught me. In fact, my latest book, I said, I dedicated it to all who taught me.
Yes.
I suppose some of them would be shocked.
Yeah. Well, they feature in it, those teachers. And there's one particular, is it Mr. Phillips who gave you your best advice about writing, which was to say, what was it? I think an economical style would suit you, Geoffrey.
That's right.
And when
I had a lovely ballarat sentence, it would write alongside it in my handwritten essays, flabby.
Yeah. I mean, it's wonderful you listened to your teacher so well and noted all that. Claire, your books, I mean, particularly Forgotten Rebels for me is about that, looking at a story, we just think we all know it, and you include forgotten people, in this case half of them, and it's a very, very different story. What do you look towards and think, oh yes, I mean you must just look at everything and think I need to revisit it, but what particularly excites you, whether it's something you might do yourself but or you'd like to see someone else do?
Well, it is something that readers often say after reading The Forgotten Rebels, is that that they found it very disturbing. Not that the material itself is disturbing, although some of it is. Those scenes of childbirth on the goldfields are stuff of nightmares. But that they found it disconcerting because they get to the end of it and they think, well, this is a story I thought I knew, and clearly I didn't, because here's a totally different version of it. So what other stories do I think I know that might have a completely different side to them as well? So that's the kind of destabilising effect of reading a book like that. And I think, you know, there are many of them. I did start a book about the women in the Ned Kelly story, reconceptualising the Kelly gang that we always hear about as the Kelly family. And it was kind of, you know, a bit like The Sopranos meets Animal Kingdom.
I was going to say, there's a TV series.
Yeah, well, yeah. It actually was going to be. We got funding, a production company, to make that series. It was going to be called Ned Wood. And no jokes. And then in one of the various rounds of ABC funding cuts, we were in development and it was pulled. And so that's what happens when cuts happen to the ABC, actually really good projects that are there and are going to revitalise and tell us a different version of our history get wiped out altogether. And so, you know, that's just one of them, an iconic story. But at the moment, as you know, I'm really obsessed with democracy. And I'm in the middle of this democracy trilogy, the Forgotten Rebels being the first book, Your Daughters being the second. And the third one is going to be about the Yirrkala Bark petition. So I'm looking at the material heritage of Australian democracy, the Eureka flag, the women's suffrage banner,
and the Bark petition. Which is a real something Geoffrey's done all his career, and you don't see that much of anymore.
Yeah, using
material history,
using objects to tell a story.
Yeah, the Dunlop tyre.
And so this is really a way of writing Indigenous people back into mining history, because the Yirrkala Bark petition came off the back of a mining incident, the mining of bauxite in northeast Arnhem Land. But it's also about voice, and it's about people demanding a voice, which is what they did at Eureka and at Federation, women at Federation, and again in the 1960s. And just to respond to Geoffrey's point, I think that yes, technology has increased our ability to understand the depth of our past, but But Indigenous people have been telling us these stories for a long time. We're just listening to them now because we have science that backs up what the narratives and the oral histories that go back tens of thousands of years. And we respect the science more than we respect the oral histories. And I think that it has been to the advantage of certain groups like mining companies to disregard those stories and the voices of those stories. Those stories have been there, the knowledges are there, and we're listening to them more now. And I think that this has been the flip side of a different kind of version of technology. You were kind of rolling out, Sally, before the kind of moral panic version of kids and screens and access to information at a rapid rate. But I also think that knowledge has been democratised enormously. And so, you know, what I think is exciting about history writing now is that it's being written by many different people in many different forms through technology. I saw a wonderful thing the other day. Have a look at it. You know these TikToks that kids are doing all the time now? There were kids who are doing TikToks as history assignments and narrating the Russian Revolution and the Declaration of Independence in TikToks. And so I think that it doesn't mean there's not going to be a kind of historical consciousness or an interest in the past, but we are using technology in different ways. And that's, to come back to your question, what I'm excited about as well is being able to use a range of mediums to tell these stories now that we're pretty much all familiar with the idea that there is not one true story.
I love seeing your books side by side, all mingled together. They're not usually together on the shelf, not because of alphabetical order. I'm not quite sure why, but they were in different rooms, actually, today. Mm-hmm. But they're better together. It's good to see you two together. It's just been such a pleasure to have you both here, and I want to thank you for coming. I want to thank you both for the incredible contribution that you both make to helping people understand our country. And I hope there's a lot more work in both of you. I know there will be, you know, in the years to come. So, ladies and gentlemen, Claire Wright and Geoffrey Blaney, and thank you all.
Claire Wright and Geoffrey Blaney speaking with Sally Warhaft on Tuesday, the 29th of October, 2019. The Fifth Estate comes to you via the Wheeler Centre, Melbourne's home for conversations about books, writing and ideas. Check us out at wheelercentre.com, and until next time, take care.